Here we are, ma'am.
Where?
The tea lair, ma'am.
What tea lair? This place has seen much better days. And where are the table and chairs? You normally make such an effort.
There, ma'am.
Latimer, that's a mouse hole.
That's just the entrance, ma'am. It's very different inside. Far bigger than it appears from out here.
Oh, like the TARDIS.
Ma'am?
From Doctor Who, you know, his time machine thingamabob.
Oh, him. We don't talk about him in polite society, ma'am.
Why ever not?
Oh, it's a long story, ma'am. And it hasn't happened yet. Now, in order to reach the beautifully prepared tea lair, you need to drink this.
This is a real tea lair, isn't it, Latimer? Not a hallucinogenic one. I told you I'm not doing that again.
Oh, it's quite real, ma'am. Here you are.
Oh, it tastes of Sunday afternoons.
Latimer, where are you? I don't think anything has happened.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman.
There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't recently happened across a tumbler full of Loki gifts that somehow ate your life. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea lair for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and, of course, a nice cup of tea. I hope your experience of the shrinking potion was less traumatic than my own, and I hope you agree that it was worth it. This tiny network of beautiful corridors and ornate doors is absolutely fascinating. Latimer won't tell me who built these, so I think that we should keep an eye out for the Fae, just in case. I do hope the miniature clothes that were waiting for you are comfortable, and that nothing embarrassing occurred. I haven't been able to work out whether Latimer made them or someone else. Either way, I must say that you all look absolutely gorgeous.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived, a Mr. Ramez Naam.
Oh, splendid! Let's see his calling card. Oh, I suppose that's out in the ruin, as big as a house to us now.
I took the liberty of noting his credentials before we entered. A good thing, too. It was glowing.
Glowing?
Yes, ma'am. With a motif of a glowing brain. It read, Mr. Ramez Naam, Catalyst of Science Fictional Realities.
Excellent. Show him in, Latimer. For those of you who don't know, Ramez is a computer scientist, futurist, and award-winning author of non-fiction books about technical innovation, and the novels Nexus and Crux, published by Angry Robot Books. Ramez founded and ran Apex Nanotechnologies, the world's first company devoted entirely to software tools to accelerate molecular design. He holds 19 patents related to search engines, information retrieval, web browsing, artificial intelligence, and machine learning. Blimey.
Mr. Ramez Naam, ma'am.
Hello, Mez. Do come and sit down. How are you?
Well, I'm wonderful, Emma. What an interesting place. What an experience I've had getting here.
Yes. Are you feeling all right? There's no side effects from the potion?
Well, I must say I've drunk some rather odd potions in my time, but this was a unique one.
And those clothes, are they comfortable?
Yes. They're quite fine. Touching myself here, but yes, they seem to fit quite well. Thank you.
Good. So, would you care for some tea?
Tea would be lovely. Thank you.
Wonderful. How do you take it?
With cream and sugar, please.
Okie dokie. And would you like some marbled coffee cake?
Oh, my goodness. That sounds divine.
It is, and this has been baked by Latimer, so he is a marvellous, marvellous baker. Oh, no, that's not that cake. No, I do remember, Latimer, it's all right. We can't eat that cake. This is the marbled coffee cake. I'll cut you a slice. We're not allowed to have the other cake until we leave, apparently, but let's not worry about that for now. So here's your tea and cake. So don't mind the chickens over there. They've coped very well with being shrunk to our size. You're not allergic to feathers or anything, are you?
Not that I know of. And
marvelous.
I must say, do you have I was going to say a full-size kitchen, but do you have a kitchen all shrunk down to this size as well?
You know, that's a very good question. Everything was laid out when I arrived. I think Latimer must have prepared everything at normal size and then shrunk it down, because he did that with your calling card. Actually, I wanted to ask you about that. It's glowing very, very faintly. It's not dangerous, is it?
It's glowing? Really? I've never noticed that before. Oh, goodness.
Oh. Hopefully that was not the potion.
Hopefully.
I'm just going to leave that to one side over there. In my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
I have brought a top hat, but it's a shiny sequined top hat.
And it's fabulous! Why did you bring a sequined top hat?
Well, it's an article of clothing that I have, which I quite love, for those events where you want to be dressed up in finery, but you want to have that extra little bit of sparkle.
Ah, I am a huge fan of an extra bit of sparkle, I must say. I'll be sure that Latimer restores that to its proper size after we've taken tea together.
Thank you. That would be appreciated.
Now, I understand that you used to work for Microsoft, and there's something I do want to ask before we go any further. You didn't have anything to do with Clippy, did you?
No, thankfully.
I'm so pleased.
Me too.
I'm so glad, because you're so lovely, and I've enjoyed your company at several conventions now, and it would have been such a dismaying fact if you had been involved. So I'm very pleased, very pleased.
I'm very pleased that I'm allowed to walk out of here again.
Latimer was a little bit worried, but I knew you couldn't have been involved with that.
I do think they had the best of intentions.
Now, I follow you online, and I enjoy the articles you link to, and I loved the talk you gave at Worldcon, and I have the feeling that you're very optimistic when it comes to science being able to solve the major problems facing humanity. Is that a fair assessment?
I do love science, and I am an optimist about science doing good things for us. Though I do think science creates problems for us, so it's usually sort of a two steps forward, one step back sort of situation, or two things get better and one thing gets worse, and we have to learn how to fix the one problem we made while things were getting better. But in general, it moves towards better.
Is there a problem that you think science will never be able to solve?
I think there are problems that will get solved, but that science won't solve for us, that we have to solve ourselves. And I think those are problems like human selfishness, or problems like people being mean to each other, or war, or things like that. Science doesn't have the answer to that. Science can give you better medicine to cure people of their injuries sustained in war, but to actually reduce war, which we have. The world is a much more peaceful place now than ever, actually, is what the numbers tell us. But that has come out because of other things. It's come out because of advances in how we organize ourselves, which is not really science exactly.
It's tricky, isn't it? Sometimes I feel very blue about the state of humanity when I think about how messed up I am and my friends whom I adore. And then I kind of scale that up to the level of governments and countries. and think, oh dear, the common element here is that we're all human beings and we're all very messed up and didn't get the right things in childhood and whatnot, and it all just is amplified.
And we're all animals. I mean, as human beings, we're animals, so we have urges, and we evolved in tribes of a few dozen people or 50 people at a time. We didn't evolve in these giant societies and giant cities and countries, so we're sort of in a very, very strange configuration, and our wiring doesn't predispose us to do well in these situations, but somehow we're muddling through. And the thing that I often think about is the world around us is full of bad news, but part of that is because the media, and bless their hearts, I love the media, I love getting all this information, but the media gets you to pay attention more by giving you bad news. Mm. And, you know, there's a saying that they have that is, if it bleeds, it leads, which is a horrible, horrible saying.
That is awful!
It's really, really awful. Which is that, you know, a story about something terrible happening is what you put first on the nightly news, back when the nightly news was something we watched, or at the first page of the newspaper, because it captured the attention, because we're all wired to look for threats. So in the United States, for a long time, I'll give you one example. In the United States, the murder rate in the U.S. is about half of what it was now in 1980.
Wow.
But for the longest time, and even now, if you ask people, is murder more common or less common, they'll say it's more common. And what happened was that television news was just covering things more and more and more to get more and more ratings. So they were getting more stories of bad things happening, even as those things were happening, relatively speaking, less. So I think we have to keep kind of a filter on how we view things. And it's not that the world is perfect. The world is actually very, very, very messed up. but the world is getting a little bit better over time. In some ways, it's getting a lot better over time. And so I'm an optimist, but I'm also sort of an optimist realist. You can be optimistic, but not lazy about it, not complacent about it. You can be optimistic and say, okay, I'm optimistic. I think the world is getting better. But it's getting better in part because people say, here's a problem that really exists, and I'm going to go work on it and fix it. And so you can be optimistic and say, but this is still messed up over here, and I want to go tackle that, or I want to go work with people to tackle this problem and try to fix it so that the world keeps getting better.
I like that. So I want you to imagine that tomorrow you get a call from a Hollywood exec who says, Mez, like, I'm so sorry, we've been abusing science all these years. We've been making people outrun pyroclastic clouds and explosions and torrents of water and all kinds of silly things. Now, you name one stupid science thing that we do all the time that you'd never like us to do again. What would you say to him or her, but probably him, depressingly?
Probably him, depressingly. That's a really good question, actually. Well, that's one thing you just mentioned, actually, that I would say is stop making all the scientists in movies men.
Hallelujah!
My wonderful girlfriend of 4 years is a scientist. She's a PhD biologist. And now in biology, most of the people getting their PhDs right now are women, actually. A majority are women, not men. So I think that's one interesting thing. Another is stop making scientists the villain. So it happens so often in movies that and in books too, a very, very, very common plot is scientists have invented something in secret and they're going to use it to do some bad thing. Or they didn't think about the unintended consequences, and that creates some bad thing. And now our heroes have to go show the scientists the error of their ways or defeat them. But I think the more common thing in reality is there is some bad thing in the world, like malaria, and a bunch of scientists and people on the ground and activists and philanthropists and charities and volunteers are all working together to try to beat this problem. And that's maybe not sexy for Hollywood, but that's more the reality of how things go.
I think also there's a kind of a twist on that, depending on the genre, because I'm a great fan of disaster movies. I consider it to be one of my more kind of quirky flaws, but I really, really, really love them. And in those, you often have a scientist who's a hero and is the kind of maverick scientist who is kind of borderline genius, who is the only person in the universe who can possibly see what's going to happen and is yet not believed by everybody else in his team. So I think sometimes they have scientific heroes if it suits them, but yes, the majority of the time, not. And stop making them wear glasses, for goodness sake. That's the thing that really, really upset me about Pacific Rim, or one of the many things that upset me about Pacific Rim, were the scientists. I almost rage quit when they were just these really irritating, socially malformed guys, like men, in glasses. It was like, no, really, can we not evolve past this? I know so many scientists who are very cool and very sexy and male and female, and they don't all wear glasses, and they are far more socially able than the vast majority of writers I know, thank you. So it really annoys me. Anyway, just, I'm not going to stop ranting.
There are lots of extroverted scientists. There are scientists who love to dance and scientists who, you know, do all sorts of interesting, fun things and are
inept.
And on that point of the rogue maverick scientist, this is another thing that's very hard to convey accurately in fiction. And maybe people don't care that much, but almost all science is done in teams. Once upon a time, mostly hundreds of years ago, you could have one scientist would make some big breakthrough. But nowadays, most science is done in teams of people working together. And usually it's not even just one team in one place, but it's usually a collaboration across many different places. So it's almost never the maverick scientist rogue who is right. It's usually a collaboration of many scientists working together that cracks the scientific mystery. And that's also hard to show off in fiction, where you have only limited time and so many characters.
Yeah. So if you could choose one of the following augmentations, which would you choose? A photographic memory, muscles that never tire, or control over your own endorphins?
I think I would choose the photographic memory.
So would I.
Excellent. Good tip.
Yeah, that would be so useful, wouldn't it?
It would.
So when I have a friend over for tea, I like to ask on the Twitters if there's anyone who would love to ask my guest a question if they had the opportunity. And an interesting one came in. And the person asked, when writing science fiction, how technical / scientific can a story be without without becoming technobabble or alienating the average reader? How do you balance that?
Oh, goodness. That's a good one. I tried to write Nexus so that it was scientifically accurate, but so that you could follow things pretty well, even if you didn't know anything about the science. And also so that there are places where there's maybe a paragraph or two that builds up on the previous explanation and maybe dives a little bit in further. And I try to make it interesting, but if your eyes do glaze over at that paragraph, and hopefully never more than a paragraph, and you really don't care about anything there, it shouldn't matter.
Hmm.
You know, nothing about the plot should depend upon you mastering any scientific details. Or if it does, then those details should be explained in an interesting and fun way, and in a way that sucks the reader in and assumes that they have no basic knowledge. And again, it can't be just an info dump. It has to be in a way that is is fun enough and interesting enough and carries the reader along. I had one challenge. There's a scene in Nexus where my characters are on an airplane having to use their brains to hack a piece of software to make a change to a compiler, which is a very detailed piece of software to introduce a hack. And it's a very subtle concept, actually. And I had to explain it, and I had to make it fun to read at the same time. And it's actually relevant to the plot and to the plot of the sequel. And so I just wrote that scene 5 or 6 times and kept getting feedback from friends who read it, including friends who had no computer programming experience at all, until it made sense to them and it was fun and exciting to read. And then it, you know, once that was the case, then I knew that I had succeeded.
Because Nexus has done fabulously well, and you're up for the John W. Campbell Award as well.
Thank you. Yes, I'm very pleased that people have liked Nexus, and yes, I'm up for the Campbell Award, up against some friends, so whoever wins, I'll be very pleased.
It's a fantastic lineup for the Campbell this year, actually. I was really thrilled when I saw it.
Yeah, it is. It is really good.
I always ask a question of friends, which may seem a little odd, but I was wondering, if you could choose a theme tune for your life, what would it be?
Well, I love this question, actually. There's so many that I could choose, and you actually already told me that Mike Cole chose one of my favorite songs, which is The Emperor's March from Star Wars, which I have often said I would like to have be the music that plays when I enter a room, but Mike has already chosen it. So I have chosen one of my other favorite songs, which is O Fortuna from Karl Orff's Carmina Burana.
Oh, that is a fantastically grand piece of music.
It's big. Oh, Fortuna.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It comes
big.
Over and slaps you in the face in a very gentle and beautiful way.
Yes.
So one of the reasons I ask is because the chickens over there that have appeared completely innocuous throughout our conversation are actually quite special. And let's see if they must know this. Everybody knows this piece of music. O Fortuna by Karl Orff from Carmina Burana. Oh, and there they go. Oh, they're singing. It's so. It's nice that they know a wide range. They know Star Wars and they know the classics. It's it warms the heart.
Those are some incredible chickens. Oh, my God.
Yes. Yes, I was speculating with Aliette the other day that there must be somebody in a lab somewhere doing some interesting experiments. They were sent to me by an anonymous person. I have no idea what they're up to, but I do like these results from their lab. Or maybe they're magic.
Maybe. We should sequence their genome and see if they're science. Maybe we can find some magic that way, too. Who knows?
Oh, yes. I quite like the sound of that. Well, let me check the teapot. Well, I'm afraid we're out of tea, and we've made some good progress on this marble cake. But I'm afraid it's time for us to leave.
Well, it has been so delightful here with you.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and I'm so excited to be seeing you in a couple of weeks' time, I believe.
Yeah, I cannot wait to see you in London. It will be absolutely delightful.
I'm sure it will be. I'm really looking forward to it. Now, let me cut you a slice of this other cake, and you're under strict instructions from Latimer not to eat it until you get out of the corridor and back to the place where your clothes will be waiting, the place where you arrived and drank the potion. I'm assuming because it's going to restore you, and hopefully me a little bit later on, to our normal size. So I'll just wrap up a slice for you and give that to you, and if you just head on back down the corridor that you came down, and I will see you in London.
Okay, see you in London.
Take care now.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that was lovely, wasn't it, Latimer? Did you hear that?
Probably just raindrops, Mum. They sound very different when we're this size.
That's not a raindrop. It sounded like a cat in the corridor outside.
Don't worry, Mum. Sounds like it's being distracted by something else.
Mez! Heavens to Betsy! It's as big as a kaiju! It must think Mez is a mouse.
Don't worry, Mom. Look at the collar. It's domesticated. It won't eat him. It will merely toy with him. For days.
That's no consolation, Latimer. Mez needs to finish book 3.
Mr. Narm has stopped. That's bold.
He's waiting for it to reach him. Why? Has he been seized by some death wish? It doesn't seem in keeping with his optimism.
Perhaps he favours a swift death above slow torture. It is more dignified, after all.
Oh, he's ducked under the cat's chin and is climbing up its leg. He's far more nimble than I thought he'd be.
Yes, Mum.
It's lucky the cat is wearing that collar. He's got something to catch hold of. What's he doing, Latimer?
I believe he's tickling it behind the ear, Mum. Devilish. What cat can resist such charms?
Well, the cat certainly seems calmer. Goodness, that purr is so loud. Thank goodness he's coaxing it outside. It will save our ears. How considerate of him. Once they're out there, he'll be able to eat the cake, and all will be well.
Yes, Mum.
Well, whilst Latimer is wrapping our slices of cake, I'd just like to mention our very own Patreon page, where you can become a member of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the Order and discover how Latimer became my butler, go to www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy. Speaking of which, I'd like to raise my teacup to Ron Davis, with special thanks for creating the beautiful crest for the Order of the Sacred Teacup, Jeff Woolliscroft, who has fine taste in teapots, and the very lovely Finula Murphy. Latimer, could you find us a new location for the tea lair? Preferably one that's more modern and doesn't require magical shrinking to enter it.
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find out more and join in.